Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Well, people often ask writers and myself where their ideas come from. Many will tell you they spark from real life, from actual incidents, or from personal experiences, and I'd certainly agree with that. Today's guest author, I suspect, would also agree. She's Lisa McGuinness, and her new novel, Across the Deep, is definitely inspired by real life, by situations that she has seen and been involved with. Described as a perfect mix of tragedy and humor, love and loss, pain and redemption, the overall message of Across the Deep is hope and second chances. Lisa McGuinness is the creative director at Mango Publishing. She was the founder of Yellow Pear Press and the imprint Bon Ami Press. She's a 25-year veteran of the publishing industry and has worked in the editorial, the sales, and production divisions during her tenure at Chronicle Books. She's also worked as an editor at Diablo Magazine and on numerous books and publications during her many years as a freelancer. Lisa's the author of several books herself and the co-author of several children's books, including the New York Times bestseller, Bee and Me, and Baby Turtle's Tale. They're both animated picture books written under the pen name L.J. McGuinness. For today, we're going to call her Lisa McGuinness because that's her name, and she's joining me right now. Her book is called Across the Deep. Lisa McGuinness, welcome. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
My pleasure. And there's so much to talk about today, but I want to begin with a quote by somebody who blurbed your book for you, Across the Deep. Author Catherine Armstrong, she wrote Dream House, and she says about your book, Across the Deep plunges us into a brutal world while uplifting us with an unlikely sisterhood that brims with love, determination, and the joy of a second chance at life. So before we get into your story, I want to begin with a little more of your background, because I think maybe it's why you were interested in writing Across the Deep. By day, as I said in the intro, you're a creative director. You work with authors, designers, editors, and you're also the executive director of an organization called Search. Would you tell us what Search is and why you do that, what you do there?
I would be so happy to. Thanks. So it's interesting because I had the idea for this novel when I was at an event, and there's a woman named Sarah Ocko who was talking about her experiences in working in a safe house or helping out in a safe house in Southeast Asia. And I had one of those moments, you know, one of those life-changing moments when you're like, I need to be a part of this in some way. When she was telling about just the experiences the women have had, some of, you know, these young, they're really children, you know, young teen girls, and some really terrible experiences they've had. And I thought, oh my gosh, I need to in some way be part of the solution, even if it's the teeniest, tiniest way. And there was a handout that had been given at the event, and I just had this flood of an idea of a novel that I wanted to write that addressed it, but not just addressed the horrors of it, but also gave an element of hope, because that's one of the beauties of this safe house that she's working in. So anyway, I started scrawling all over this handout, and later I got in touch with her, and I had a meeting, and I told her, you know, about how moved I was by learning about this. And she said, you know what, you have to come and actually go to the safe house with me. And again, just I knew that this was something that I wanted to be a part of. And so she, at that point, was going once or twice a year. I went over with a group of people, and I met with these two women who run a safe house in Southeast Asia, and then several young women and teen girls who are living in this safe house. And it's just was an incredible, incredible experience. So I have been back several times, and then about 2 years ago now, a group of us who have been several times wanted to start a nonprofit to actually give them really specific support, you know, like raise money so that they could build a home or purchase land so that there could be an exit strategy for
yes.
these women and children who are in this home so that they can, learn skills and become educated and have a way to enter life as, you know, not victims, but as people who can be out in society with some skills to live.
Right.
And so we started this nonprofit called the acronym is SEARCH. It stands for Southeast Asia Rescue Coalition and Haven. It is a handful. But we officially have our nonprofit status, and it's something we are extremely excited about, very passionate about. And in case anybody wants to check it out, the website is called searchforhope.org. The four is the number four, so searchforhope.org. And it's an extremely worthy organization.
Yes, and it's a massive problem. It is so huge. I did a couple of shows on it, and I just was staggered by how huge a problem this is. And in fact, when I did one of the shows, the FBI had just raided, I think, 170 houses up here in the Washington area where this was going on. So sex trafficking was going on. So I'm guessing that your work with that is what led you to want to write the book. And so let's take a look at the book so listeners know what we're talking about when we're talking about Across the Deep. It's described as a perfect mix of tragedy and humor, love and laughs, pain and redemption. And it basically follows the lives of these two young women who were brought over to San Francisco. The story begins by introducing Suda, who's locked in a shipping container in the cargo hold of a ship. And she's been trafficked from Thailand to San Francisco. So please share your storyline.
Sure. So one of the things that I wanted to do is show that it's not just something that happens, you know, in other places. This is something that does happen in other places, but it also happens right here in the United States. And as you said, like, you know, even in Seattle, where you are, it's all, you know, there were all these raids. I'm, you know, here outside of San Francisco. It's everywhere. And it is really heartbreaking. But one thing I do want people to know is that even though there are tough parts in this novel, it's really about healing and hope. But anyway, so to answer your question, it starts out with Suda. She is indeed in a shipping container because it is extremely unfortunate, but that does happen to people. And she ends up here in the United States. You know, it's so tricky not to give away too much information, but I can say that she makes her way to a safe house. And there she meets another character named Claire, who is somebody who had been trafficked locally. And in the safe house, there also are other another young woman, but also the two directors, and there is also another character is named Chai. He is a detective who's trying to work to stop sex trafficking. And then there is another character who is somebody who is from Thailand who is looking for Suda. And so they all come together, and we get each of their unique stories. But one of the things I tried to do is also see what each character thinks about the other character. And so we get to see them through their own eyes, but we also get to see the characters through the eyes of the other characters in the story.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about your protagonist, Suda, and how you compiled her character. Was it based on some of the young women that you met?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. So there's a lot of background on her childhood. One of the women who I know who is working at, actually she's working at an orphanage in Thailand, but it's very similar to her early childhood story, actually. growing up in a hill town, undocumented. There are a lot of people, you know, men, women, children in Thailand who live in the hill communities who are undocumented. And then once you're undocumented, you have absolutely no access to education, social services. I mean, you're not really known, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So, because they're born without birth certificates and, you know, they're not born in hospitals. And it's just something that it's amazing to people who, you know, haven't experienced that this is still going on. But anyway, it makes people particularly vulnerable. And students' early childhood, yes, is based on somebody who I know personally. And then her story when she gets here is 100% fiction.
Okay, good. And so then, you know, given the work that you've done with Search, as we mentioned earlier, I'm guessing a lot of your research was already known firsthand. What kind of issues did you have to explore further to capture the details for your characters and your storyline? What gaps did you have to research to make this real?
Excuse me, that's a great question. And I really, for the most part, it was you know, going there, meeting people, talking to people, hearing their stories, understanding that I am really in no way really capable of helping them directly. It's about helping the other women who are helping them, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, there's no sense of like, oh, we're coming in as saviors to help these unfortunate people. No, it's we're trying to support these amazing women who run a safe house. And so a lot of firsthand information. But then in addition, of course, I had to do research on just trafficking in general, what's happening in the United States. I went to a couple of lectures. I read some firsthand account autobiographies by women who have been through this, you know, harrowing experience, because I wanted to understand as much as I could while understanding that there's no way I can understand. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a very difficult subject to wrap your head around, because the people who are, you know, head of these sex trafficking rings, they absolutely seem soulless. I've watched several documentaries on these rings, and you can't even look at these people as human almost. It's shocking.
It is shocking. It really is shocking. And soulless, I feel like, is the right description, because there's no compassion. There's no empathy. There's nothing. There's no humanity.
Yeah.
For the women who they're trafficking.
Hmm. What of your research shocked you the most? I'm sure you saw a lot that was making you gasp along the way, but what do you think was most shocking to you?
Well, there was one image, and I'm trying to remember if it was in a newspaper article or I can't remember where I came across this image, but it was of this incredibly tiny storage space at the, like, underneath a building where they had been hiding these girls because they knew they were going to be raided. And I just thought about these girls, these children, these girls who are being sexually abused by people. It's just unfathomably horrible.
Mm. Yeah.
And so that's one of the images that is kind of seared into my brain. I'm also somebody who has a daughter, so of course you can't help thinking about the horrors of it from that perspective. And then one of the things, though, that I do also want to point out, though, is just the hope and the healing that can be involved. Because in the safe house where I go and volunteer once or twice a year in Southeast Asia, it is so beautiful to watch these women come together as a healing community. The support they give each other is so beautiful. And just their intense resilience. Like, there's one young woman who is in the safe house who refused to comply, and she was beaten and refused to comply and ended up escaping, which is practically unheard of, and she made her way to the safe house. And so that's one of the reasons I put a scene that I try not to make it too intense or, you know, too bleak, where Suda is being forced to comply, and just how terrible it is to know that you no longer have control of your life, that somebody else is controlling your life and your body.
Yes, and they're just being treated as a commodity. But, you know, as you said, the key thing is not just helping them escape, but build the skills they need to survive and thrive. And, you know, thankfully, there are great organizations around doing that. You mentioned, I was going to ask you how, as a mother, this impacted you. And you mentioned you have a daughter. I know you have two grown children. And we should probably say, you know, your story focuses on mainly these two young girls and their life in the safe house. But boys are not excluded from this, too. Boys are very heavily trafficked, too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and absolutely. And there are also boys in the safe house where I volunteer. But interestingly enough, the reason that I had to make it all females, because when I had drafted my story outline, I had one young man in it, but what I then learned as I was doing my research is in at least California, where I am, there are so many rules and regulations that surround safe houses, and one of those is making sure that people are in same sex, at least from the research that I did, people have to stay in same sex community. Because already, as they're healing and there's so much emotional damage, and then people act out in various risky ways because of that, that in order to keep people safe, they have to keep people in communities that are same sex.
Yes,
so I
makes sense.
Switched, and I mean it all women.
Yeah, makes sense. You're an author who's published several books now, and fiction and children's books too. How did writing this book help you grow as a writer? I think each time we finish a project, we take something away from it. How did this help you grow as a writer?
Oh, that's such a great question. And it's interesting because I think that I'm a little bit unusually diverse in what I write, because I have written some children's books, I've written some lifestyle books, and I have written two novels. And each one is incredibly unique, but in each case, I have grown a lot as a writer. And when I wrote my first novel, which is called Katarina's Ring, which also is about hope and healing, that one, it was that first novel. It's funny because I remember I was writing, and writing a lot of dialogue, and it was really the first time I had written dialogue, and I thought, oh my gosh, I'm really good at this. Like, I'm a natural, right? And then I sent it to my agent, and she got back to me, and she was like, yeah, FYI, your dialogue is horrible. And it was so funny, because she said, you're not understanding what dialogue does. Dialogue is nothing like real dialogue. Dialogue has to move the story forward.
Right.
And I was like, oh, gosh,
right.
She is so right. So I really honed my dialogue writing skills on that one. For this one, one of the things that I really worked on, and I feel like it helped me take my writing to the next level, is just trying to write more eloquently, better word choices, better turn of phrase, showing the story. You know, everyone always says, like, show it, don't tell it. And, like, we all know that. But writing, you know, I did a draft, and I thought it was in pretty good shape. And then I went through, and I made so many different word choices and rewrote little things to make it more beautifully written. And I tried to really show things in a much more descriptive way. And then I got to a point where I thought, okay, this is, you know, this is pretty good. But as you know, because I know you're a writer too, it takes so many rounds until you're actually there. And how do you even know when you're ever done, you know?
Yeah.
So at that point, I gave it to one of my friends, and she is a really amazing editor. And she read it, and she said, you know what, this is good, but I really feel like you can do better. And it was one of those moments where I was like, oh, dang it, she's right. You know, she's right. I can do better. And so I did another round. Again, finesse. Gave it back to her. She pushed me further on some things. And at some point, I was kind of, I don't know if you've ever experienced this, but feeling like, ah, my gosh, it's fine. You know, and then having to say to yourself, no, just fine isn't enough. It has to really be beautiful. And so I think in answer to your question, with this one, what I took away is how incredibly important it is to try and keep going, keep working until every word is the right word and every scene is truly something that people can see in their mind's eye.
Love it. Love it. Well, that's a good segue into another question I was going to ask you, because I've asked this question of many authors and I get many, many different answers. And that question is, how do they know when their novel is complete? And I read a blog post that you wrote. You wrote, every time I read my manuscript, I see some paraphrasing here. Every time I read my manuscript, I see some small horror or a thread dropped and I'm terrified to let it go. So how do you eventually know when it's finished? And I actually loved the tidbit that you shared, that somebody shared with you, a novel is never finished, only abandoned to the public.
And I think that that is exactly true, because you know what? I don't think they ever are. Because if I reread my book again right now, I'm sure I would want to change things. I am 100% sure. And, I mean, nothing substantial, you know what I mean? But it's, again, it's the word choices, the turn of phrase, the cringeworthy moments that you go like, how could I have written that?
Yeah.
You know? But I especially think if I reread Katerina's Ring, like, because now for that one I've had almost, I think, about 5 years. And so I think the more time you have in between writing something, the more you can see it with kind of a dispassionate, detached view where you can see the flaws more easily. So, I mean, I would say that's the reason I put that quote in my blog post. And that is that's exactly how I feel. They are never done. I think at some point you just hit your deadline and your editor says, okay, fine.
Yeah, and I agree with, you know, you said bottom line, basically, you said it's okay to be uncertain. And I agree with that, because I think if you're absolutely certain of something, you know, 9 times out of 10, you're really not. You find something along the way. I want to talk about self-promotion, because obviously we're in a time where people can't meet in person and do the usual round of book signings and stuff. And you talked about this too on your blog, that you miss, you know, that's a big miss for a lot of authors who've got new books coming out. And you say that self-promotion isn't something you're comfortable with, and I certainly was raised that way too. You know, who do you think you are? Don't get too big for your britches, and you know, you let other people tell you how good you are. You don't have to go around broadcasting it. So how do you deal with that right now? How are you coping and meeting the challenges that this time is bringing?
You know what, I have to say, I am not coping very well. I'm not coping very well in the sense that I am really having a difficult time with self-promoting. I mean, thank you so much for reading my blog, by the way. That is so nice. I was raised, you don't toot your own horn, right? And that's just such a different way than things are now. You know, now it's all about self-promoting, build your brand. And I'm pushing myself to do that, but it's a very uncomfortable place for me. And I actually have wonderful friends who will send me messages saying, what have you done today to promote your book? And then I will send a message back saying, of course, I've done nothing, so thank you very much, and now I will post something, you know. But I have to say, actually, just as somebody who's part of the writing and publishing community, I miss book events, not only for myself, but just to attend. You know, it's such a great community, and attending book events is a wonderful way to be a part of the community. So I definitely miss it. So far, I have. I was a guest blogger on a really fantastic blog by a woman named Cynthia Newberry Martin called "Spending Days," and that was great. I had a virtual book event, which was really fun. Actually, I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I think the people who attended it as well. You know, it's obviously more difficult to be as engaging over Zoom, but I got lots of good feedback. I am doing this, which is so kind and gracious. So I kind of feel like, to a certain degree, I've had a little taste of all the different mediums we're using these days.
Right, right. It's a different, you know, I'm used to doing Zoom meetings. I've done them for years, but it does wear a little thin. And it's especially different when you're doing an event, because when you have a live event, like when I'm doing live radio, I like that liveness, because, you know, you're in the moment. If you screw up, everybody sees it. There's no cutting and taping and editing, you know, and you just have to, you know, be yourself and go with the flow, I think. So a lot of people miss that.
And I think you get that energy too from people's responses.
Yes, most definitely. I want to talk a little about, because I know we're running out of time here, but I want to talk about the difference for you between writing a novel versus a children's book. I'm wondering if when you write a children's book, do you have something that you keep at the front of your mind when developing a book for young readers? Do you go in with a guiding mission when you set out? How is it different for you?
Oh, gosh, yeah, it's really, really different. And interestingly enough, I can speak to this as both a writer and an editor, because I've edited a lot of children's books as well. And one of the things that is so tricky with children's books is, again, you know, back to the whole perfect word choice, but with children's books, you have so few words that you have to treat each one as a pretty serious commodity. You know, it really has to do some work. It has to be interesting. It has to be lively. It has to move the story forward. And so I think I always think of it, I don't know if this is the real term, but I would call it writing tight, you know, where you have to really use each word so carefully. And I love that challenge.
Yes.
That to me is fun and enjoyable. And, you know, of course, if you're writing a novel, you just have such a bonanza of space and words and sentences and scenes that you can just be so much more expansive. But I thoroughly enjoyed both of them. And it's interesting because the first two children's books I did as a co-author, and we published under a pen name. We combined our names, so it's L.J. McGinnis. And the first one was called Bee and Me, and the second one was called Baby Turtle's Tale. And those ones we had specifically been asked by the publisher whether or not we would be interested in writing these particular books, because they wanted to do a series of about some endangered animals, and so bees were one of them and turtles were another. And so that one was also interesting because we were prescribed this topic, you know, and then we had a really good time bouncing ideas off of each other. How do we want to do it? What do we want the story to be? And then we wrote it together and edited each other's, and it was really a super fun process. And then the next children's book we did also with my same co-author, Leslie Joniff. So that one is called The Dictionary of Ordinary Extraordinary Animals, and that one, I got the idea to do that because my son at the time was, I'm trying to remember, like late elementary school age, and he was so fixated with animals and just found animals to be so incredibly intriguing. And so I started trying to find just weird characteristics of animals and interesting tidbits about animals. And I realized I was gathering all, just was becoming this, you know, walking statistic about, you know, wacky tidbits about dolphins and, you know, whatnot. And so I ran the idea by my friend Leslie and my friend and co-author. And we thought, oh my gosh, that sounds super fun. Let's do that. And so we proposed the book. That one was published by Running Press. And they loved the idea. And so that was all about research, you know, to make sure that we had all of our facts straight. Because the last thing we wanted to do is, you know, say that dolphins only sleep a half a brain at a time and then find out that that's just not even true.
Right,
you know?
Right. Well, I love that you write such diverse books, because often people are told when they're beginning, just write in one genre, or, you know, in my commercial business, just focus on one specific thing, one topic. And I think life's a bit more interesting than that. I love, you know, this good diversity. If you do it well, it's good to be diverse. So it's been great talking with you. And I know...
Oh, thank you.
I know that listeners can find out more about Across the Deep at your website, lisamcguinnesswrites.com, lisamcguinnesswrites.com. A final thought you'd like to leave them with today?
You know, the only thing that I would say is I hope that in some small way, the goal of Across the Deep has been to spread the word about sex trafficking, which, of course, we're all becoming more and more aware of. But also, I want people to know about the hopefulness and healing that is possible for people who are survivors of sex trafficking. So know that, yes, there are some tough parts of this book, but also it's so much about redemption, healing, friendship, love, caring about each other. So those are the two things that I would say.
Yeah, key to mention there. Well, Lisa McGuinness, thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great.
Yeah, it's fun. And listeners, I want to thank you for joining us today. If you have questions, comments, or feedback on today's show, you can find me through our website at conversationslive.net. Please join us next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.